Thanks for listening to this message from the life of St. Bees. We're a church that loves to empower, equip and inspire. And in order to better fulfill this call, we're currently undertaking an audacious church relocation project. Find out more, including how you can take part, at www.goandgrow.london. Thank you, and may this message better help you to live a life full of adventurous faith.
Thank you. So, it's a new term, a new sermon series, and we try and give you advance notice of what the sermon series is going to be about, and so you will have seen, I'm sure, in the program and directory, and you'll have seen it on the bulletin. So if I were to ask you, without looking now, what is the title of this term's sermon series? Because you've already seen it on the screen. There we go. Good guess. On the front line. And I wonder if you're wondering what it's going to be about. So why don't you take a moment just internally to think, I wonder what a sermon series entitled On the Front Line could possibly be about, and then turn to someone near you and say, I think it's going to be about, and tell them. And then later in the service, you may be able to turn to them again with a very satisfied look on your face and say, see, I told you so. So why don't you take a minute just to think, what might a sermon series entitled On the Front Line be all about? And then turn to someone and tell them what you think it's going to be about. And whilst you're doing that as well, if you haven't got a copy of the church Bible or another version of the Bible in front of you and you'd like one, could you raise a hand and our wonderful, long-suffering, ever-serving hospitality team will come and put a copy of the church Bible in your hand, because it will be quite useful for you to be able to follow the reading when we get to a little bit later. So take a minute, think, talk to one another, what might a sermon series entitled On the Front Line be all about? Okay, well, everyone who put a hand up for a Bible now seems to have got one. So that would, oh no, one more Bible to go. So hopefully by now you've at least told one person what you think this series might be about. And as we go along, you'll find out whether you were right. One of the things that we're going to be doing this term as a part of this series is we're going to be looking together at a couple of Paul's letters, the two letters that Paul wrote to the church in Thessalonica, the letters that we know as 1 and 2 Thessalonians. And I always find it helpful to know something about how Paul's letters came to be written. So let's have a quick look and see why Paul wrote these letters. As you probably know, the Apostle Paul made three quite lengthy trips, which are known as his missionary journeys. And if you have got a copy of the church Bible, if you actually turn right to the back, just before the pages turn from white to blue, the last of the white pages has a map on it that has Paul's missionary journeys. And it tells you there, you can look either a dotted line, a solid line, or a line of dashes will tell you about Paul's first, second, and third missionary journeys. And we're looking at Paul's second missionary journey. It was during the second of these journeys, and the map that's actually on the screen now shows the route that Paul took on this second missionary journey. It's recorded from Acts chapter 15, verse 40, through to Acts chapter 18, verse 22. We're going to pick up the story in Acts chapter 16, and everything that we're going to be hearing about takes place in the area of modern-day Greece. So let's just have a quick look at a modern map to get our bearings, and there on the map of Greece as it is today, you'll see Greece, Athens down there in the south, and up in the north, you'll see that's where Thessalonica is. So it's all happening in modern-day Greece. In New Testament times, it wasn't known as Greece. It was divided into two areas. The area in the north was known as Macedonia, and the area in the south was known as Achaia. And the first part of Acts chapter 16 tells us about Paul's experience in Philippi. And so just quickly see that on the map. Philippi is the next place. Philippi is in the region of Macedonia. The well-known story in Philippi, Paul was arrested, beaten, put in prison, miraculously released by God. And you can read all about his time there in Acts chapter 16. And once the Roman officials in Philippi realized that Paul and Silas were Roman citizens, so they had arrested and publicly beaten two Roman citizens and then put them in prison without a trial, they were quite keen to get rid of Paul and Silas and get them out of the area as quickly as possible. And so we take up the story in Acts chapter 16 and verse 39, which you'll find on page 1050 of the church Bibles. That's Acts chapter 16, verse 39, page 1050. They, that is the Roman officers, came to appease them, Paul and Silas, and escorted them from the prison, requesting them to leave the city. After Paul and Silas came out of the prison, they went to Lydia's house, where they met with the believers and encouraged them. Then they left. When Paul and his companions had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica. And so again, quick look at a close-up version of the map. You'll see exactly where Paul goes from Philippi through Amphipolis and Apollonia to Thessalonica. In fact, if you have a quick look at that area right in the middle, it says there Chalkidiki. And if you've ever been on holiday to Greece, to Chalkidiki, you've been to this very region. You may not have realized it when you were there, but Thompson will take you there, an area of great biblical interest. Anyway, we're thinking about Thessalonica, so let's come back to Acts chapter 17. When Paul and his companions had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. As was his custom, Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that the Messiah had to suffer and rise from the dead. "This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Messiah," he said. Some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks and not a few prominent women. But other Jews were jealous, so they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace, formed a mob, and started a riot in the city. They rushed to Jason's house in search of Paul and Silas in order to bring them out to the crowd. But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some other believers before the city officials, shouting, "These men who have caused trouble all over the world have come here now, and Jason has welcomed them into his house. They are all defying Caesar's decrees, saying that there is another king, one called Jesus." When they heard this, the crowd and the city officials were thrown into turmoil. Then they put Jason and the others on bail and let them go. As soon as it was night, the believers sent Paul and Silas away to Berea. And so Paul's time of ministry in Thessalonica comes to an abrupt end as he's very hastily bundled out of the city at night and sent off to Berea. Let's keep up to speed with where we are on the map. Here on the map is showing you where Berea is. And Luke, who wrote Acts, was obviously very impressed with the people of Berea. Let's read on. Let's read what he says about them. It says, "Now the Berean Jews were of more noble character than those in Thessalonica, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the Scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. Many of them believed, as did also a number of prominent Greek women and many Greek men." Now, this next 2 minutes, not related to the sermon at all. It's just a little bit of bonus material. You know, on a DVD, you sometimes get bonus material. This is a bit of bonus material. Because Paul never wrote a letter to the Bereans, we never really think about them. They just get this mention here. But Luke obviously thinks very highly of them and gives them this commendation. And I was wondering why. Why does Luke single them out for special attention? And I think it's because when he met them and heard about them, he thought, those people are just like me. Because if you think about it, remember what Luke said at the beginning of his gospel. He said, "I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning so that you might know the certainty of the things you have been taught." And here he meets these people, and they carefully investigate everything so they can know the certainty of what they've been taught. And Luke thinks, kindred spirits. These are good people. They're like me. They take things seriously. They don't just take what they hear at first value. They look into the scriptures to see whether it's true or not. That's a good example. And it's a good example for us to follow. It's an example we would encourage you to follow. We believe that with great sincerity we preach from the Bible. But we would encourage you, take what we say and go home and look at the Bible for yourself and see whether it's true. And if it is, then you believe it entirely. If it isn't, please come and tell us. Because if we're preaching something that isn't true, we want to know that. So the Bereans set a really good example, and Luke commends them because he was like that. End of bonus material. Back to the main DVD now. Let's pick up the passage again in Acts chapter 17, verse 13. But when the Jews in Thessalonica heard that Paul was preaching the word of God at Berea, some of them went there too, agitating the crowd and stirring them up. The believers immediately sent Paul to the coast, but Silas and Timothy stayed at Berea. Those who escorted Paul brought him to Athens and then left with instructions for Silas and Timothy to join him as soon as possible. So Paul is now in Athens. And again, as you can see from the map, this is in the neighboring region of Achaia, which is sort of all the bit of Greece south of Macedonia. Paul's now in Athens, all by himself, waiting for Silas and Timothy to join him. He doesn't waste his time. You can read in Acts chapter 17 what he got up to. But whilst he's in Athens, one of the things that is on Paul's mind is a concern for those people who had become followers of Jesus in Thessalonica, because he'd only been with them for such a short period of time. If you remember, we're told that he preached there for 3 Sabbaths. So the maximum period of time that he could have been there was 27 days, because if it had been 28 days, it would have included a 4th Sabbath. So the maximum period of time that Paul could possibly have been in Thessalonica was 27 days, and maybe less than that. And then he had to leave very abruptly at night. So naturally, he's very concerned to know how things are going there. In fact, he wanted to go back to Thessalonica and see how things were getting on. And he made plans to go back to Thessalonica. And we know this because Paul tells us this in his first letter to the Thessalonians. So let's now pick up the story in 1 Thessalonians. This is on page 1122, where we pick up the story, because Paul is now writing in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 17. He says, "But brothers and sisters, when we were orphaned by being separated from you for a short time, in person, but not in thought, out of our intense longing, we made every effort to see you. For we wanted to come to you. Certainly I, Paul, did again and again, but Satan blocked our way." And so Paul's plans to go back to Thessalonica are thwarted. Now remember, Paul was alone in Athens, but had given instructions for Silas and Timothy to join him. And we don't know whether Timothy actually joined him or whether Paul sent a message to him or not, but we pick it up a little bit later where Paul says, "So when we could stand it no longer, we thought it best to be left by ourselves in Athens. We sent Timothy, who is our brother and co-worker in God's service in spreading the gospel of Christ, to strengthen and encourage you in your faith, so that no one would be unsettled by these trials. You know quite well that we are destined for them. In fact, when we were with you, we kept telling you that we would be persecuted, and it turned out that way, as you well know. For this reason, when I could stand it no longer, I sent to find out about your faith. I was afraid that in some way the tempter had tempted you and that our labors might have been in vain." So Paul can't get there, so he sends Timothy to Thessalonica to see how things are going, to strengthen those new believers. And after some time, we don't know quite how long, after some time, Timothy comes back and reports to Paul and gives him an up-to-date account of how things are going in Thessalonica. And to Paul's great relief, it's good news. We read further, 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 6. "But Timothy has just come to us now from you, and has brought good news about your faith and love. He has told us that you always have pleasant memory of us and that you long to see us just as we also long to see you. Now, there are also a couple of pastoral issues that have arisen that Timothy tells Paul about. So as soon as Paul hears the good news from Thessalonica and hears about the pastoral issues, he immediately writes them a letter. And the letter is the one that we have and know as 1 Thessalonians. Then a little bit later, Paul gets another report from Thessalonica that there are another couple of issues that have arisen, but things are still generally good, so he sends them another letter very soon afterwards, which is our 2 Thessalonians. And then these two letters together are what we're going to be looking at as part of this On the Front Line series. I just want to pick up one little phrase from Paul's letter to the Thessalonians and think about it this morning. And it's a phrase that we didn't actually read, so we'll go back and read it now in 1 Thessalonians 2, verses 18 to 20. We read this first verse. Paul says, "We wanted to come to you. Certainly I, Paul, did again and again, but Satan blocked our way." And now, just for a moment, switching from the TNIV to the Message translation, Paul says this, "Who do you think we're going to be proud of when our Master Jesus appears if it's not you? You are our pride and joy." The church at Thessalonica is a church that Paul is really pleased with and really proud of. And so he tells them, "You're our pride and joy." Now that's quite an accolade coming from the Apostle Paul, isn't it, when you think about it? The last letter we looked at was Paul's letter to the Galatians. And when Paul wrote to the Galatians, he said, "You foolish Galatians!" So he wasn't one to mix his words and mince his words. You know, he told it as it was. So when Paul says to these people, "You're our pride and joy," this is praise indeed. And he repeats it more than once. 1 Thessalonians 3, verse 9. "How can we thank God enough for you in return for all the joy we have in the presence of our God because of you?" And then when he writes this second letter to them, 2 Thessalonians 1, verse 4, again back to the message, he says, "We're so proud of you. You're so steady and determined in your faith despite all the hard times that have come down on you. We tell everyone we meet in the churches all about you." I can imagine they would be quite pleased when they read that. You know, that's not bad, is it? Getting a letter from the Apostle Paul that says, "I'm proud of you. I tell everyone about you. You're my pride and joy." So what was it? What was it about the Thessalonians? These followers of Jesus in Thessalonica, what was it about them that caused Paul to be able to say, "You are our pride and joy"? Well, I think one of the things is in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, and he says this in verse 7, "You became a model to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. The Lord's message rang out from you not only in Macedonia and Achaia, your faith in God has become known everywhere." Let's go back to the map. There's Thessalonica up in the north, and Thessalonica is in Macedonia. And so one of the things that Paul is saying to them that he is proud of is the fact that as soon as they became followers of Jesus, they started to make an impact on the people around them. And they started where they were, in Macedonia. That's where they were. That's where God had placed them. Thessalonica, there in Macedonia. So they started right away to have an impact on the people of Macedonia. And yes, then they got a vision and a burden for the next region, which was Achaia in the south. But they started right where they were because Macedonia for them was home. It was where they were. Macedonia for them was not foreign missions. Macedonia was home missions. It was right where they were. Macedonia was, if you like, their front line. So this term we're going to be looking at what it means for them and for us to be on the front line. And we're going to look at these two letters to see more of what that means. But then when we finish looking at the letters to the Thessalonians, we're going to do something different in the second part of the term. And I want to tell you about that as well. In the second part of the term, we're going to be using some material from the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity. They're a great organization who exist, as it says on their website there, to equip Christians and churches for whole life discipleship in the world. And if you want to look them up, there's their website address there. And one of their really helpful resources is called Fruitfulness on the Front Line. There's a book by Mark Green of that title. There's a DVD course. And we're going to get to use this material in the second half of the term. And that's where we got the title from, On the Front Line. That's where we got the graphics from. LICC kindly gave us permission to use their graphics free of charge. So we're blatantly using their material and their graphics because they're better than we could design. So On the Front Line is their material. And Mark Green, who wrote the book, very helpfully gives a definition of what he means by the front line. He says this, by front line, I'm primarily meaning, he says, a place or a time where we meet fairly regularly with people who don't know Jesus. For the Thessalonians, it was Macedonia. And we're going to be looking at what it means for us. What is our front line? What is your individual front line? What are the times or the places where you meet fairly regularly with people who don't know Jesus? We'll come back to that in a moment. If you have looked at the program and the directory, and the reason we publish this is so that you will look at it. That's just a little bit of insight there. The reason we do this is so that you'll have information. From time to time, people say to us, wouldn't it be really helpful if we had a list of all staff members and how to contact them? Gosh, we do. That's why we publish it. But we also put in it about the Sunday services and what the titles are. And if you've looked through there already, you'll see that the subjects that are covered in that about what it looks like on the front line, what does fruitfulness look like, what does it mean to be doing well on the front line, then there are six subjects that we'll look at, and they're coming up on the screen now. They are to be modeling godly character, to be making good work, to be doing our daily jobs well, to be ministering grace and love, molding culture, being a mouthpiece for truth and justice, and being a messenger of the gospel. We'll get to that in the second half of the term. For today, I want to come back to this idea of the front line. What is the front line? Remember Mark Green's definition, a place or a time where we meet fairly regularly with people who don't know Jesus. Now, have you been wondering what the significance is of all the squares with the dots? If you hadn't been wondering, you might like to wonder now. Oh, I wonder what the significance is of the squares with the dots. Well, have a look closely. Look at the one right at the bottom. Let's go to that one. Let's enlarge that one. That's right at the bottom. A square of gray dots with a cluster of red dots in the bottom left-hand corner. The red dots are intended to represent you and me and people like us who know Jesus. And the gray dots represent people who don't know Jesus. And so that little graphic there, right at the bottom, represents us meeting together. There we are, all gathered together in a corner, close to one another, all very cozy, all very comfortable. And if you're the kind of person who likes data rather than graphic images, you've probably already counted that there are seven red dots. And there are eight gray dots directly next to or close to a red dot. So our impact there is on eight gray dots. But the rest of the squares on the left-hand side look a little bit more like this. And the red dots still represent us. And the gray dots still represent people who don't know Jesus. And this represents us when we're not gathered together. This represents us when we're scattered around. None of us there next to another red dot, so not quite so cozy and so comfortable. And if you noticed, how many of those squares are there on the screen? 6 of those squares and 1 of the first. So one day in the week, on a Sunday, we gather together and we have this lovely experience of being together. Don't knock it, it's good. God tells us to do it. But 6 days in the week, it looks like that. We're not together. We're spread out, we're separated, we're scattered. That's the front line. The gray dots that are around us, that's our front line. The people that we regularly meet with who don't know Jesus. And those of you who did the maths last time, how many gray dots now are directly next to or in close contact to a red dot? 53. Our impact is greater when we are scattered than when we are together. Remember one of the things that Caroline talked about in that Go and Grow video, she said, used a little phrase that one of the reasons that we want to be moving and is to be more prominent and to encourage every individual to live an intentional missional lifestyle was the phrase she used. To live on the front line, to recognize that where we are day by day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, surrounded by people who do not know Jesus. That's the front line. So the key question for all of us this morning is, what is your front line? What and where are the times or places where you meet fairly regularly with people who don't know Jesus? Just take a moment and think about it. That's really what we're going to do for the rest of our time, is just think about that. What is your front line? For some of you, it's probably quite obvious. For some of you, it will be your workplace. That's your front line. That's where you spend most of the days of the week in that kind of scenario. And if the workplace is your front line, and you are not yet in a missional community, then you may be interested to talk to Nikki about the God at Work missional community that she is restarting this term. Because it's going to focus on how you can be living an intentional missional lifestyle on the front line in your workplace. For some of you, it may be where you study. For some of you, it may be at the gym. I've never been in one, but some of you go to them. That's your front line. For some of you, it may be the parents of other children that you meet through the different activities that your children are involved in. And if so, and you're not yet in a missional community, then you may be interested to talk to Jonathan or Jeanette Burnett, who will be continuing to host the family's missional community gatherings that Elliot started before he left. Or Tim and Caroline have also been involved in that, who are actually here. So talk to them. Jonathan and Jeanette will be at 11:30. Talk to Tim and Caroline. What's your front line? What are the times, what are the places that you meet fairly regularly with people who do not yet know Jesus? Now, you may be struggling and you may think, I'm not sure I've got a front line. Let me read you a story from this book, Fruitfulness on the Front Line. The story says this, Gateshead, that's where it took place. Wednesday evening, about 8:30 p.m., Isabel's house, Isabel's front room, Isabel's cups and plates and cakes. The home group is meeting. We used to have those, now we have missional communities. They're thinking about where their individual front lines might be. They're thinking about where they spend time during their ordinary week with people who don't know Jesus. They've been going round the room, and it's Isabel's turn. She pauses. Well, I don't really think I have a front line. I mean, I'm retired. I look after my husband. I look after the house. I do a few things at church. I see my grandchildren. No, I don't really think I have a front line. It's one of those moments that can easily turn to embarrassment. Someone is out of sync with the crowd. Like turning up to a party dressed as a pink flamingo, only to discover that it's not a fancy dress party after all, but a formal civic reception for His Excellency the Ambassador of Saudi Arabia. There's a pause, because Isabel doesn't have a front line, and no one seems to disagree. Neil says, so tell us about your grandchildren. Isabel begins and then says, and the eldest one comes round for Sunday lunch 3 or 4 times a month. She asks about church and the sermon and so on. There's another pause. And how old is your grandchild? Neil asks. No one knew it at that moment, but Isabel's world was about to change. She's 23. The door to a new way of thinking swings wide on its hinges. She's 23. The room begins to work that through. Pretty much every Sunday, Isabel is having a significant conversation about church life and biblical teaching with someone who is not a Christian and who is 23, right slap bang in the middle of the age group that the church in the UK is finding hardest to reach. And they didn't know. The group agrees that they'd better start praying for Isabel. And the pastor, who happens to be there, starts to think about how he can include something in his sermons at 11:30 that helps Isabel with her 23-year-old granddaughter at 1:30. And Isabel realizes that she had a front line, and she hadn't seen it. What's your front line? Perhaps the band would like to make their way back up as we're drawing to a close. What and where are the times or places where you meet fairly regularly with people who don't know Jesus? Or what and where is the time or the place where you meet fairly regularly with one person who doesn't yet know Jesus? That's your front line. Let's just take a moment now just to ask the Holy Spirit to help us see what our front line is. And I want to encourage you now to do this as a real practical exercise. This is not theory. This is practice. This is practical. We're saying, what is my front line? What are those times, those places, or what is the one time and the one place that I regularly meet with one person who is not yet a follower of Jesus?